All right, at this time, I would like to introduce our speaker. It is Mike M. from Philadelphia. Mike.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. It's a privilege to be up here tonight, and I want to thank Dave for asking me. There's always no coincidences in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned. And he asked me a while ago, and I travel a lot for a living, and I'm not around. And so the first date didn't work, and he said, well, next month or whatever, at the end, I'll get you. And I haven't shared my story in quite a bit of number of years now, maybe two or three times in the last couple of years. And the traveling gets in the way. But it's no coincidence that I'm coming up on 25 years of sobriety. And it keeps me mindful all the time. I'm actually anxious as I begin tonight to share some of my story with you. And also I was thinking, who would want to listen to me for over a half an hour? You know, it's in Philly, all the meetings I go to, you sit on the edge of your seat and you wait for that, you know, guy to finish or that woman to finish within 25 to 30 minutes or get off the stage so you can say what's on your mind. So it's kind of different to be able to talk and I also said to Dave on the way up, I didn't angst over this at all. I figured I'd let, you know, or try to let God do the talking. And I guess I'd begin with what it was like and what happened to me, what my life was like, how it was intervened with by Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that are in AA and God, and what it's been like since then, which is really quite amazing to think that one day at a time, someone who began drinking at the age of 12 years old could actually be sober longer than the period of time that he drank and still survive. Not always well. One friend used to say to me, I'm sober but not well. And I think over time, when I look back, it also changes the way that I look at my life the way it was. But I grew up in Philadelphia. I was born in Logan in Philadelphia. I was the middle of seven kids born in an Irish Catholic family. We were, the oldest was only 8.5 years older than the youngest. So my parents were busy, busy people. And although my mother said they only had sex 8 times, and that could well be. My father ran through about 20 couches, and the cigarette burns were all over the floor, you know, and used to watch, at least in those days, the flag go up at, you know, 12 o'clock when the TV went off, and that's where Sonny, we used to nicknamed him Sonny Jim, he slept on the couch. But a family of Irish Catholics predominantly, heavy drinkers for the most part, lots of children, lots of cousins, but everybody drank, and it seems when I look back at that, every wedding, every christening, every funeral, every day, every Phillies game, every Eagles game, every, there was a drink. And that's what people did. And I just took that for granted. But I also remember the chaos, and I think of this in a way, when I was born, my mother was, she was in a place called Misericordia Hospital out in Larchwood Avenue in West Philadelphia. And she had what the Catholics call extreme unction or last rites. She almost died when she had me because I was, like everything else in my life, ass backwards. I was a breech birth. And she, on top of the breech birth, she had a gallbladder attack. And I remember sitting for years after that as a kid, and my great aunts, who were old maids and weren't married, used to come to the house all the time, and my Elizabeth Haley and these others, and my grandmother saying, do you know the pain you caused your mother? Do you know the trouble you caused your mother? Don't you ever talk back. Don't you ever, don't you. And when I think about alcoholism, equal to the alcoholism to me was guilt. And I was addicted to guilt. And if there wasn't something to be guilty about, I could find it very quickly, aside from being born literally, not just figuratively. And when I went to school, grade school, and I'm I do church work today, and I have a great deal of gratitude to the church. I'll just preface this. The person who introduced me really to sobriety was a Catholic priest. There was a lot that I got from the church, both bad and good and ugly in many ways. But I remember, too, always, you know, Valentine's Day or this day or that day, we would make up these cards, and it would say, "Dear Mom and Dad, thank you for having me. Thank you for feeding me. Thank you for this. Thank you for that. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you." And to God, thank you, God, thank you, God. And then there was a lot of guilt. There's a guy who lectured out of South Jersey, Vince DePasquale, and he talks about the Holy Trinity of fear, guilt, and dependency. And I remember every night kneeling down, and we used to do this act of contrition. And the reason you did the act of contrition was in case you had committed any serious mortal sins that would estrange you from you and your higher power that day, if you died in your sleep, you'd go right to hell. So the way I looked at it is if you said the act of contrition, which is you explained to God that you were heartily sorry for all of your offenses, you would at least buy some time until you could get to confession and tell a priest what you had done. And this was dead serious. This was in earnest, this stuff. And we took it in. And I remember an old priest theologian friend, he was kind of laughing about this later, years later, when I was chatting with him, who had taught me at Temple. And he said, "You know, Michael," he said, "the thing is, if your house isn't crazy, that stuff isn't so literal to you. But when it's crazy in your house, that stuff about Adam and Eve and the enmity and being kicked out of the garden and all that, and, you know, the man and the woman wouldn't be getting along. Well, they certainly didn't get along in my house. And my mother saw my father as her cross. He was what she had to bear. And that's what would actually win her redemption and get her to heaven if she stayed with him. So, again, marriage was till death do you part. Anyway, at the age of 12 or 13, in this household, I found something that was wonderful. I was in somebody's house in the suburbs, and I was watching the kids, I guess. I think I was like a fill-in babysitter for these two kids, and they had a bottle of vermouth in the house, and I stole it. I took it out, and I put it in the bushes. I guess that's why you don't let boys babysit. And anyway, I took the bottle of vermouth. And then we were hanging out in Philly. We'd go, you know, our exciting life was you hung out on corners. You stood on a corner. It could be 10 degrees with your Converse sneakers, freezing to death and spitting. You have piles of spit, and you'd smoke cigarettes. And by the time you were 13 or 14, you drank. You got the older guys, the old head. They would go get you your quarts of beer or whatever, and that's what we would do. But I took this bottle of vermouth. I'm 13 or 12, whatever I was, and I drank it. And I'll never forget how I felt. I just felt so relieved. I felt calm, kind of ecstatic. And all that anxiety, all that, like, that worry and all the bullshit and the fear all the time of all these things sort of subsided, and I was altered. And I'll never forget that. I got sick afterwards, but I went back to it. And by freshman year in high school, every single weekend, every Friday and Saturday night, we got alcohol and we drank ourselves silly till we either threw up or whatever, till we ran out of beer and didn't drink the hard stuff. Mostly that. We smoked cigarettes and we smoked pot. And I'll never forget waiting, like everything was about that Friday night. And here's this little punk. He's, you know, my feet barely touched the floor in my desk. And I couldn't wait for Friday night to get drunk. And the rest of the week was an arduous kind of anxiety-filled deal. Getting through school was a nightmare. I always tried to bypass the exams, not take them or pass them. And it was always one way or another. I remember geometry, taking the test and ripping them up, throwing them out, and going up and telling the teacher that he didn't give me my test back. And it was Pete Fallon, and I made amends to him later. And he said, "Oh, Mort, I'll give you a 70. I say, "Thank you, sir. Don't lose it again." And then I'd sit down. But I got through high school and didn't know very much. I had a decent brain. And there was very few of us who didn't get passed along. And this is the grace of God to me. Somehow I got accepted at the university, at Temple. They had open enrollment. They would take anybody in and they would flunk anybody out. But I remember getting in. And that was one of those many, many moments in my life of grace where I was given opportunities. I drank silly through those years. I basically looked at life in a very negative way. Through the lens of the alcoholic, I saw life as difficult. I saw people as untrustworthy and undependable. Relationships between men and women were horrible. And the last thing in my life I ever wanted to do was be married to one of you women. That's for dang sure. And that Adam and Eve story really resonated with me. You know, what happened to them? They were in paradise, right? And then all of a sudden they were thrown out and the cherubim are there. And, you know, he's going to earn his living through the thorns and the thistles and the sweat of his brow. And she's going to bear the kids in pain. I thought, that's the world I know. Why does that happen? Have another drink. And by sophomore year in high school, we were getting served at the bar down on Old York Road in Philadelphia in Oak Lane. And Reds, the bartender, I guess he paid off the captain or whatever. But by junior year, sophomore year, we're sitting closing the bar on the weekends. And in the summer, because I worked usually at a part-time job, I always had money, we would close the bar. And I would come home, and my father would be sitting there, you know, on the couch, getting ready to go to sleep and watching the flag come down or whatever. But he never said a word. And I realize now, looking back on that, that was okay. You could drink all you wanted to. And when people did things crazy at family functions, the excuse all the time was, well, Uncle Bill was drunk. Or he was under the influence and didn't know any better. Or he never would have done that sober. Or he's a really nice guy when he's not drunk. But you could get away with just about anything drunk. And the rest of us would kind of look at that and figure that makes sense. He wasn't responsible for himself. I had one uncle who was sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. He never talked about it. He never mentioned it. And I never understood anything about an alternative way of living. I didn't really know what alcoholism was. By, I guess, my second year at the university, I dropped out. Now, most people get through Temple in 5 years. It only took me 9 because I was very, very intelligent. And I would go through little phases of abstinence where I would tell myself this wasn't good, this drinking business. It wasn't getting me anywhere. And my family would always, I had a terribly bad alcoholic uncle. He was the youngest of my father's brothers, and Barney died on Skid Row. And I remember he would get cleaned up, and he would stop at the house, and the first thing my father would do is offer Barney a beer. And my mother would have a fit and say, don't you understand? And my, you know, cousin Chuck would say, you know, Dad didn't get it. In his mind, alcohol was not the problem. It was a weak constitution on the individual. And as I thought about this too, took this in, regardless of what I knew, my experience was that if I couldn't control my drinking, I was a weak individual. And not only with the booze and the alcohol, but with anything. If I had issues about anything or concerns about anything, I mean, the world I grew up in was pretty crappy in some ways. Certain days, people were mean. You know, there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of verbal abuse. There was a lot of physical stuff. And I had a pretty nasty mouth myself. You know, I could really hurt people with my tongue. And we were mean kids. And it didn't dawn on me till years and years later, sober many years, how actually horrendous sometimes the way we treated each other. It was really awful. Not just in the house and in the family setting, but at the schoolyard, in the community, at the lunchyard. I grew up in the crazy 70s, so there was all kinds of racial tension, and there were cops on the buses, and there were people throwing bottles when you got out of school, that kind of thing. But there was always, for me, alcohol. There was always a place to go and take care of that. And as I got older, I realized that 24/7, this was my place. And what I learned was, not just what it did to me, because it certainly hurt me in many ways, but it seemed to do an awful lot for me. It allowed me in some way to tolerate intolerable things, insufferable situations, the unbearable loneliness or isolation or the just the violence in the house that went on with people physically and otherwise, sexually, etc., to tolerate things that are intolerable. That's what I found alcohol allowed me to do. And I realized, too, when I finally found myself invited to AA, I was teaching high school, and I remember very clearly how well I related to the freshmen. Guess what? You know, I was there. That's where I was, about 13, 14. So I had a wonderful time early on in sobriety. But anyway, I continued to drink and try to stop. And then I went to Florida. I had a brother who was in the Navy, and he was down in Pensacola, Florida. And I met this guy, and his name was Michael. And he was a Messianic Jew, Jews for Jesus. And he took me to church, and he baptized me in the Holy Spirit. Honest to God, I spoke in tongues. I don't know that I could ever repeat it, folks. But anyway, it worked for a while. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. And I never said the F-bomb. I mean, that was like my favorite word, mofo, F. That's all. Every other word out of our mouths practically had it began with an F. And it was our wonderful expletive, adjective, you know, adverb, noun, verb, whatever. It was everything described everyone, every context you were in. It would be effing good, effing bad, effing this, whatever. But I came back, and I remember I wasn't cursing. And that was strange. You know what I mean? Like somebody told me, and I think about that to this day, they said, Mike, your language is not really healthy. And you know what? You're a pissed off person. I say, oh, no, I'm fine. And they said, nah, all that F talk and all that, that's a sign of how angry you are about stuff. And I used to think, no, I'm happy face, you know, I'm a nice guy. I'm the guy, like, I'll sell you a car or whatever, but I'm a nice guy. And I didn't want to buy that. But I stayed sober for a year after that. Didn't touch a thing. And it was very, very miraculous. And then I went to a monastery. Yes, believe it or not. I went and I lived with these Trappist monks for about 3 months. And there was something else I discovered that I had never known before in my life. And to this day, when I talk about this, I feel it. There was a monk and an author there. His name was Father Basil, and he was about 6'6", big, huge guy. And he was a writer and author, was very famous. And I had no idea who he was, but he befriended me. And I remember being in the kitchen washing dishes on a Sunday afternoon. He'd say, do you want to take a walk? So we'd walk and we'd talk. And Basil would listen to me. And over a period of a couple months, something happened to me. I wasn't drinking. I was sober. I was completely out of my environment. I was getting up at 3:30 in the morning and, you know, going to the church and praying and doing the Psalms and working. I was hauling fieldstone and driving this big combine and doing all this kind of work for a little city punk. It was kind of neat, different. But I'll never forget the relationship with this guy, Father Basil. And I realized to this day, it was a loving man. He was a father to me that I never had. And it was astounding to me that I was lovable. And this guy was, I didn't know him from Adam. And then I didn't realize until later that he was a famous guy in his circles and in the world and all. But he took that time with me. And I remember he gave me a little plaque when I left. And it said, the person whose joy is God, basically, need never be sad. I remember putting that up in my workshop years later and just remembering that. But I'll never forget the power of that love and affection that man had for me. And I carried that with me. And he died about 3 years ago. And I maintained almost 35 years plus that relationship where I go back and visit him and see him. But I never forgot what that meant in terms of what he gave me. And I bring that up for another reason. When I left the monastery, actually, I went to work in Doylestown at a kid's home for emotionally disturbed adolescents. And I didn't realize I was still one of them. And these were kids like you, you know, I mean, you had to like fight with them to go to bed. You fought with them to get up. You had to stand in front of the door jamb and wait for them to run their head at you, you know. And there was kids and they go to the Edison lockup for hitting somebody in the head with a horseshoe. I mean, they were really sad kids. And I learned a lot from them. You know, they had been sired by their granddad, and the just craziness that went on with these kids. And I met a woman there. And what was really weird about this was I hadn't drank in quite a while. I wasn't smoking. I was a pretty healthy guy. I'd run a couple miles a day. I did my prayer life. As soon as I met this woman, I went to the bar. And I started drinking. Now, isn't that something? And the rest of the story is going to be about her. No. You've heard this before. If you had a wife like mine, you'd drink too. She wasn't the healthiest person in the world. She hadn't been to the monastery, after all, and met Father Basil. But she had no idea what she was getting into with me. And we had a rocky, rocky courtship. And I remember I didn't know how to get out of it. I was in it, and I couldn't get out of it. And while she was much more upfront than I was, for me, once you got into bed with somebody, that was it. You were done. You were obligated for life. You had just done what Adam and Eve did, and you were doomed. You were out of the garden, and that was it. I couldn't figure this out. I mean, my adult daughters would laugh me off the podium here, but or my sons. But to me, I took it dead seriously. And so I didn't know how to stay in it, and I didn't know how to get out of it. And we moved in together, and I went to an old blind priest. This is like a bad movie. By now, I'm drinking pretty regularly. I'm drinking more than I should be, daily. And he looks at me with his blind eyes, and he says, get her out of there. You're playing with fire. And I went back home, and I said, that's it. It's over. And she had a fit and wailed and gnashed her teeth, and I said, I guess it's not. We went to bed, and lo and behold, there was a child conceived. I know, that's an unusual story. and then I thought, man, now I'm responsible. My father, who I was very much like in a lot of ways, and I was the fourth son in 4 years, so like my mother got the first three. They were all mama's boys, but I was dad's buddy. I drank with them, you know, we trashed the world, we commiserated about how bad lawyers were, real estate people, and the racial situation, and, you know, politics, and the whole thing. And I was a lot like him. But what I remember about him was, I don't think he had a clue how to love, but he was very dutiful, and he was always there. He always paid the bills. If you got arrested or whatever happened, he always came, he got you. You know, he paid the phone bill. He took care of things. He was very dependable. He was also predictable. And I remember when he died, he said, life is really horrible. This was his picture. This is why we called him Sonny Jim. He said, you know, you sit and you work, you break your ass all your life. You do this, you do that. And he said, and then you die and your wife gets the car, the phone, and the insurance. And that's all they want, Michael. That's all they want. And that was the bleak picture he had of marriage. And in all fairness to the guy, he wasn't my mother's first love. She'd been widowed in World War II, so he was competing with a ghost. Her mother died when she was 8. She was competing with the ghost. Her uncles died. Her brother died. There was tuberculosis epidemic in Philadelphia at that time. So anyway, the poor man lived in a world of ghosts, and he could never measure up. And I inherited a good deal of that inadequacy. But in any case, once this kid was in the oven and ready to be baked, I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I got to be there for Junior. What would I want? I went to Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative, which is, you can only do that which you would will everyone else to do if they were in your shoes. And I'd want, especially my opinion of, you know, what's that? Oh, his categorical imperative. It was the great rule, kind of like the gospel that says, do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. And my father's response to this was, you got to raise the kid. My mother's was, you got to raise the kid. And we went back and forth and back and forth. And my first wife was really much more sane than I was. But we even went to this farm, place called The Farm in Tennessee. And they had a bunch of babies there and women. And Stephen, I think his first name was. I forget the guy's last name. He was one of these gurus in the 60s. And anyway, I'm home drinking. I mean, half a gallon of wine. And I look in the mirror and my face melts. I mean, it was scary. I was like psychotic at times. It was horrible. It was the ugliness on the inside coming out. And the wine didn't help any in terms of the image. And I remember getting this call at 2:30 a.m. I'm drunk as a skunk. And there's this voice, a woman's voice. It was probably my mother. And she's saying, that's your kid. You have to go get him and you have to this. And so I get on a plane. I fly down there and I rescue and I bring them back and we get married. Of course, Junior's at the wedding. He's breastfeeding at the wedding. And in my family, you don't do that stuff. You just don't. But I was such a rebel. I waited till he was born. I didn't, you know, play around with that. We got married, and it was up and down. And I guess if I were to use one word that was key in my life, maybe still is ambivalence. To be or not to be, that's the question. To love or not to love, to give myself to this or not give myself to that. I mean, who the hell takes 9 years to get a bachelor's degree unless you're in night school? And then what am I going to be when I, you know, what am I going to be when I grow up? What am I going to do? And I was never satisfied. Completely discontented and terrified, really. So I did a lot of different things. And that poor woman suffered those injuries tremendously, as well as my first three children, who are now 32, 30, and 25. And like my father, I was always there for them. But I was in this thing, and I didn't know how to get out of it. And that was how it was. I was in it, didn't want to be in it, didn't know how to get out of it all the time. I was terrified, and yet at the same time, I was obnoxious and bold about things. And I drank. And finally, I remember thinking about my drink, and I talked to my old man about it, and he said, it's okay. He said, you're just taking your comfort. It's not a problem. And I didn't do any other drugs, really. I couldn't smoke pot because of my lungs. But I drank all the time, whether I was happy or whether I wasn't happy. Whether life was good or whether it was bad, whether there was money in the bank or whether there wasn't money in the bank. And I would teach and then quit. I had a painting business, a home improvement business. I dug ditches. I scrubbed floors when I was unemployed, whatever. It didn't matter. And I had some good, you know, other like jobs that I really liked. And I remember I wanted to teach, and it was something I really loved to do. I enjoyed it tremendously. Never even thought about a paycheck when I taught, especially high school kids. And I remember I got the job teaching again. And I remember I started to lose my short-term memory. And I would go into school and I'd have my lesson plan set up and so on. And I was forgetting stuff. And I was barely getting into school. You know, when you teach, it's beastly, those bells. They just ring. And they ring every 50 minutes and you have to be there or else. Especially when you're teaching with nuns. I was teaching at a girls' school for a while, and then later at Roman at the boys' school. But I remember going in and having that frustration. I was feeling tired physically. But I was also getting off the bus. I'd take the Y bus, Cotman 73 in Philadelphia, and I'd get off the bus, and I'd maybe have $2 left. And I'd go to the Lord Cheltenham, which was a dive on Cheltenham Avenue, and I'd go in there, and I'd spend my last $2. And then that would start me for the evening, and I'd go home. Of course, I had a terribly expensive mortgage. I think it was $200 a month. on 65th Avenue in Philly. But I couldn't stop the drinking. And one of the other things, which I am not proud of at all, is occasionally I would get really angry with my kids, and I think I would terrorize them, more verbally than anything else. But it was the kind of deal where you walk in the door, and Mom says, Micah did this, you know, or Susanna did this or that. And what I felt was obligated to do something. I remember my father. I remember us all being lined up when the old man came home in Logan, and he'd take the belt off, you know, and we'd all line up, and this one did this, and that one did that, and my father would go, I hate to do this to you, whack, I hate to do this, whack, you know. And he would be the dispenser of the corporal punishment, and I was raised by the hand. When you did something, you got hit across the face, the back of the head, whatever it was. And I still, the worst incident was the old man putting my older brother's head against the pipes because he had done something to my other brother's thumb fighting. And I'll never forget seeing that. And I realize now where he lived and grew up, 12th and Columbia Avenue, that was life. That's how you grew up. And, you know, there wasn't much you could do about that. As civilized as we were, because to the whole world, we were a wonderful family. Anyway, I came home this one day, and I remember just being very, very tired, being burned out. And it was something that my son had done, who was a very live wire. And I remember having been introduced to AA once and gone to a meeting and then gone back out and drinking. But I went up and I had... And I get a little emotional when I talk about this. But I picked the kid up, and I'm shaking him. He's about 7. And I'm shaking him, and I thought, man, I can't do this. And I put him down really gently after doing that. And I can you imagine, you know, I'm just thinking, can you imagine there's this guy screaming and shaking you like a cartoon character, you know, the Hulk. And you're a little guy, and he's to this day, he's a very loving son. Although he could kick my behind in a heartbeat, a lot bigger than I am. And I put him down and I went to a meeting. And I'll never forget it. It was out on City Line Avenue. It was a Friday night, 11-step meeting. And they said, is there anyone here for their first time? Da 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 da. And I bolted out of my seat. And I said, I'm Mike, I'm an alcoholic. And they all clapped. And I took a deep breath. And that was November 23rd, 1985. And I haven't had a drink since then. And you see, just like the Father Basil love, it's also the love that's in us, I think, that showed me something. And alcohol numbed everything for me. It numbed the bad, and it also numbed the good. It numbed the hatred, but it also numbed out the love. And I had no decent judgment. I couldn't figure out the forest through the trees. And I still think of, when I think of alcoholism, I think of it as an emotional, mental, spiritual, physical disorder, but a real disease of the emotions. I was incapable of expressing intimacy or love as a drunk. And it's only through many, many meetings and many, many years and faulty relationships that I've even learned a little bit about how to do that, how to be. But anyway, I took like a duck to water with AA. I found a home group in Glenside. I still go there quite frequently. Well, I go to lots of other meetings too. I still go to a lot of meetings. I still depend heavily on AA and my relationships in it, even though a lot of the men are dead that I originally knew when I came in. They're long gone. I found in sobriety some other issues, though. Once the alcohol went down and I, through the grace of God, was relieved of that obsession by going to the... It took about a year. It was a very painful year. And I remember literally for the first time in my life learning what white-knuckling it meant, because I'd be driving to the meeting and my hands would be frozen around the steering wheel and I'd be screaming and cursing with everything in my being on the way to that meeting. You burn! I'd scream, and it was ungodly, but I didn't drink. And I'd get to the meeting. I had a sponsor, read the big book constantly. I got the 24-hour book, which I still read to this day. It's the same book that the guy who took me to my first AA meeting, the priest, who, by the way this program works, I think, came to my school to do a retreat. We had to do a retreat every year with the kids. And I got this guy to come. I had asked a friend priest who couldn't come. This other guy came who doesn't even like kids. And he really doesn't. And he came into the sacristy of the church chapel in the school, and we started talking about alcohol. And I have no idea why, but we did. And then he invited me down to the bar on Rising Sun Avenue in Philadelphia, and I drank, and he drank ginger ale. And then he invited me to these meetings. And then after that, he did an amazing job of 12-stepping me. He called me. He gave me literature. He introduced me to people. And in Philly in those days, this is only 25 years ago, I remember, like, they would come over and give you tickets to the anniversary dinner. Uncle Vincent, DePaul McManus, an alcoholic of my own conviction. I still remember him having me and my three kids at his camp up in the Poconos. And I remember one of them having diarrhea, you know, all over the place. And he had an outhouse. But they were very loving people. And they would go the mile with you. And Uncle Vince would always say, I dare you to come back. I dare you to come back. And so I got to know people. And I got to know them without being drunk. And I got to know them without putting on a facade or a mask, although it took me a long time to reduce that. And I remember in those early meetings when I would come into a room, I didn't want you to see me. I was a neurotic mess, full of fear, self-loathing. I didn't talk. I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to be called on. I was terrified. I didn't want anybody to know I was in AA. I went to those meetings. But very quickly, I was 32, 33, I was feeling the benefits. And what I always felt I got in AA was what I got from that monk, Father Basil. People loved me. And they made me feel very welcome. And they made me feel normal, something I had never felt in my life. Never. Always the odd man out. I used to wish, you know what a lobotomy is, right? I used to think if the sons of the guns, if they could just drill right here and pull this thing out of me, I'd be fine. Like I had some kind of, and it was alcoholism. I don't mean to reduce it to some simplistic, it's not, it's what it was. I had an illness, and I didn't know it. And nobody else that I lived or grew up with understood it. We just practiced it. And it was for us, in a sense, normal, and it was reinforced in many ways the way we thought about God. You know, I think younger people, my kids, I have six kids now. And I think the youngest ones, I mean, if you were to tell them about a terrifying God, they'd think you were talking about Harry Potter or, you know, some myth or something. They wouldn't have a clue what you were talking about. It wouldn't dawn on them that that was the case. Anyway, after 4.5 or so years sober, the reality of my marriage came to a head. And I felt that it wasn't right for me. And impulsively, I decided that I was going to find another way. Now, in my family, the only way you get out of a marriage is you die. I had two cousins who suicided. And Johnny blew his brains out at 7 a.m. on Sunday morning. He had six little kids. But I'm serious. I was going to use the pun. I'm dead serious. You were allowed to suicide, but you weren't allowed to leave your wife. And even though it seemed like our life was improving in some ways, there was a deep dissatisfaction that I had. And I went, and I bring this up, it's a huge part of my story. And I won't say in retrospect, because I don't know what God's will is most of the time. But I know that when I go below the waist, I get very confused. And when I used to teach boys, I used to say, fellas, you got two headsets. You got one set up here and one down here. And you better get the communication worked out before you make your choices. And I realized one of the things I had not learned, even as an adult, even with three kids, I knew little or nothing about men and women, about intimacy, about love, commitment. I was still functioning under the banner of duty. That was it. And this whole concept of actually loving somebody, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, and Tavia asks Zelda, they're married for 90 years, and the kid says, I'm leaving, I'm getting married, and I fell in love, and the old man says, what are you talking about? You have arranged marriages, you marry this, and he looks at his wife, he says, do you love me? And she says, I wash your socks, I cook your meals. He says, no, do you love me? I raise your kids, I do all this stuff. And I thought about that, and I thought about my life, and I wanted something. And what I realize now, a few years later, is I put down alcohol, but there was a lot of things I didn't put down. There was a whole lot of other switching that went on in terms of what kept me from being in touch with who I was and how I was. Whether it was other relationships with people, whether it was work, whether it was money. Thank God it wasn't drugs and prostitution and different things that maybe would have gotten me into trouble that way. But there's a whole bunch of stuff out there that's just sitting there waiting to take the place of alcohol for most of us. And what I realized is all of that would bring me back to a bottle. And anyway, my wife and I separated, and I didn't go to the bar. I didn't go here, there, and everywhere. I went to AA. And somehow I navigated with help through that. And it was a very, it was kind of a depressing, crazy situation in my life. Today, my ex-wife and I, who actually she lives near here, I just saw her Sunday. We're very amicable. I don't know, we might even get along better than I do with my wife. But anyway, because we don't have to live with each other, I think that may be the reason. But as a sober person, I was able. And I raised the three kids. They came and they lived with me. And I remarried. And I had three more children. And in the course of all of that, what I learned was that I was given opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to make my life whatever God's will was for my life. And as long as I didn't pick up the drink, as long as I didn't get drunk, and I've worked in the prison system, and I've worked professionally with a lot of impaired individuals who have lost their careers, their licenses to practice medicine, all kinds of different things, and men who didn't look like they should be in jail. And I used to go in and do this workshop, and I'd look at this guy and I'd say, what are you doing here? And he'd say, I had too much to drink, maybe not even alcoholic. And he said, my car went up on the curb and I hit a kid and she died. And he said, I'm doing 5 years. And this is in a state correctional institution, 5 years. And I thought, there but for the grace of God go I. I mean, I was going through the toll booths on the turnpike with my beer. And the only thing I was worried about was whether it would spill. Did you ever have that happen to you? I spent all Thanksgiving out near Elizabethtown with my ex-father-in-law with a crotch completely beer-soaked from when I went through the toll thing. I mean, talk about some of the simple benefits of not drinking. Not to mention the legal issues. When I look at how it is today, I still have living problems. I still have problems with my wife and my children, with my God. I have a lot of stuff as I get older. I mean, medically, physically, I feel like I got fairly blessed. Hair loss is my biggest concern. But when I think about the things that I did, drunk, hungover, going up aluminum ladders that were piled against tension wires, sitting on aluminum extension poles 40 feet in the air to reach one of the overhangs on a old house in Wincote, that's crazy. That's totally insane. Sitting and eating lunch in asbestos that we just grinded off the side of a house while me and George Higgins are sharing a quart of beer and this stuff's all over our food. That's insanity. gone out of the house to pick up my son and stop in at Jim's Cottage Inn. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, leaving, going over to my parents, we're about a mile away, and picking up my son with my father's complete look of disgust, because I literally had every good intention of being there to pick him up. And in sobriety, life is very, very different. And what I experienced today, my youngest, now this is my insanity, my youngest is now 11. My oldest is 32 and my stepson is 37. So I have my other addictions. But what I have to offer them, my oldest son, biological son, was 7 or 8 when I was sober. My one-year-old, and this was, I got sober literally almost a year to the day of my father's death. He dropped dead at 69. And I remember rushing over to the house. My mother was very upset, although I think she might have been secretly glad. And he's laying on the floor, and his arm is up like this to the telephone. And his eyes are open, you know, and there he is. There's Sonny Jim. And his rigor mortis already set in, kind of. She was away all day. And he used to say, thank God for the telephone. If anything happens to you, you can get to the phone and call for help. A man of deep faith. And I don't mean to be sarcastic, but he wasn't. And very little trust. But I'll never forget putting his arm down and closing the eyelids and remembering his comment, life is a bitch and then you die and your wife gets the car, the life insurance, and the phone. And I thought, ain't going to happen to me. But I also realized the hell that was created for everyone else. Misery loves company. And I think in sobriety what I discovered was that that doesn't have to be the case. And you know how we say, one day at a time, I can choose to drink or not to drink. I will never be able to control alcohol. But today I have a choice. Today I have a choice to be with my wife or to leave my wife. I have a choice to be the kind of person that I would like to be. And even at 57, I can still think about changing a career, changing a job, telling my boss. Did you ever tell your boss truthfully where to go? This happened to me. It was, I had, of course, it was a woman, the poor woman, but it was a young woman, and I'd been around the block doing what I do for years and years, and it was kind of like, oh, Keen, that's really cool. Now you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And I remember saying, you know, I'm going to hang up on you right now. And she said, why? I said, before I could really go off on you. And I got fired. But I felt so good. I had never felt so good. And I didn't foul out. I just did what I did and then went to my meetings and actually ended up with my old job with a 30% raise. So I think, again, the rewards of the program are absolutely amazing to me. And what I would, I guess, finish this up with is what I struggle with every day, and I believe is really important, one, because of my children, because of the world we live in, is AA to me taught me to accept not only myself, but other human beings as children of God, to love them and the capacity to be loved. What my wife, who I'm married to now, taught me was how terrified I was to be loved. Absolutely scared the living hell out of me. And I pushed her away and pushed her away. I mean, it was okay for me to express my love, but to receive it would make me vulnerable. And I can put down the booze. I can do all kinds of things. And I can grow up and get a beard and everything else. But inside, there's a little pissant in there who's terrified of being hurt, terrified of being effaced or not seen or betrayed. And that's the way that I look at that. So as an adult today, it's like Bill Wilson said. He said, we don't live to stay sober. We stay sober to learn how to live, to love, and to learn. And as soon as you even begin to get it, the world we live in offers us what? It wants us to pursue what? The Christmas catalogs are already out. My kid's on the computer looking up boots. She doesn't need boots. You know, the stuff goes out to Goodwill, the Salvation Army. You stain the cabinets and they're not too dark, they're not too light, and one of them wants this color and one wants that. And what it really taught me, and I remember, is, you know, AA number 3, was it, or 2, who went to Carl Jung. And he said, if you want to get it right, he said, it's this shift from a material to a spiritual way of life. And the biggest thing I struggle with today is the ego. You know, easing God out and allowing myself to get sucked back in to the 100-yard dash of power, prestige, and image. And it doesn't matter whether I live in a ghetto or whether I live in the most expensive, exclusive neighborhood in the world. It's the same business. Am I big enough? Do I have enough? Do I do enough? It's all crap. The question is, am I lovable? Do I love? Am I loved? Is my relationship with God, myself, and those closest to me biologically as good as it can be? And am I willing to risk being loved? That's what AA boils down to me. And the joy of coming to the rooms, and why I think this works too, besides from the grace of God, is we share a common past. I may have never seen you before in my life, but we're a community that travels along that road of sobriety. And Josiah Royce, he said, a community is a group of people with a common past, a future hope, and the ability to see each other in the present. And that's what AA is to me. That's where I belong. And I have to come here in order to be there. And I think, after 25 years, I'm sort of realizing that that is an absolute in my life. There are certain things that I have to do in order to be. But the good news is that I can be, with the grace of God, the fellowship of AA, and you all. With that, I'll end, and thank you very much, and thank you, Dave.